We're in Ecclesiastes, the third chapter. Don't let anybody tell you that the Bible doesn't impact society as a whole. How many are old enough that they can remember the bird song? Yeah, Ecclesiastes 3. One of my very favorite songs, and I have enjoyed that no end. And it's unfortunate that people think that the Bible just doesn't have anything to say to contemporary society. Now, I think in the context of that song, they probably missed the point that's here in Ecclesiastes 3, but somebody had been reading this, and I'm glad that they did. So let's read together Ecclesiastes 3. We're going to start in verse 1. And this is the beautiful poem that became the song. For everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to break down, a time to build up. A time to weep, a time to laugh. A time to mourn, a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away. A time to rend, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, a time to speak. A time to love, a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. All of these contrasts that are here, just a wonderful, wonderful reminder that life is full of changes. I think that's the point that Solomon is trying to make here. So let me pause at this point and get your observations about the first 8 verses. And then we'll go on. We'll talk about how I think Solomon, or the Solomon figure, the teacher figure, is going to describe this poem. Any thoughts at this point? Yeah. Jim?
Well, we are all subject to time and changes in our life, many of which we have no control over.
Okay.
But they're subject to God's control. And, you know, we think about, and the one that I think about is, none of us are really prepared for grief. You know, if you have a loved one that passes away suddenly, or a loved one that passes away over a long period of time, after suffering for a long period of time, and you kind of expect the passing to happen, the grief is the same. And so it's in God's time and in God's hands, and we often have no control over it. There's also a time to dance and a time for happiness, and God builds those into our lives. So I think that this is kind of cementing that we're all subject to that, and sometimes we don't have control.
Okay. Yeah, Ted?
Whenever I read this section, it reminds me of that for me to a ninth chapter in verse 11. Where he talks about for time and chance overtake them all. And so we see that we are subject to time and to everything that happens in time, whether we control it or not. Because whether it's time or chance, you know, that's what the report. Some of us do well, and some of us do not.
Yeah, Carol?
If you think about the fact that it's time to love and the time to hate, there are those positive things that when you're loving and then it's not there, you still have to be prepared for the fact that it's not all loving. And the same thing is that you're encouraged when it's the time that there's the hating or the loss is going on. And so you're encouraged that you know that you can get out of that.
Okay. And I think that fits with what Dean said so well in his preparation for the supper this morning. You know, always remember that there's a time to love. There is a time to be disappointed in people and to hate what they do, but there's also a time to love. Yeah, Margaret.
I think it's saying all of those things have a purpose.
Okay. How so?
John was the only one of them that I could talk about. When we share a little stroke, the time to love and the time to hate, there's an appropriate place for love and there's an appropriate place for hate.
Right.
And they each have a purpose.
Right. A time for war, a time for peace. Is there a time for war? This is a question that's been debated through the centuries. Is there a just war?
Well, our lives is just war against Satan.
Okay.
And we need to be warriors. We need to be at war. We've got to fight on our side. And that takes me to Psalm 31:14-15. David says, "But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hands. Deliver me from my enemies and from those who pursue me, and let your face shine on me." So, there is time to fight the good fight. Now, wars of countries and stuff, if you look back over human history, probably so. I mean, especially in the Old Testament, we saw that's how the world was settled. That's how borders are defined. That's how we have a democracy. That's how we have different types of government across the world. God's not an American. And so we need to look at that and say that divisions have happened among men that way. And it was true, what we see in the Old Testament in particular, through the command of God. And I think that's what David is saying. There are enemies out there who are pursuing me. And you are in control of this, God. You're in control of my time.
Okay. Yeah, Carol.
You see an aggressor with the time for war. But with the people of Yugoslavia, it's a necessity. And so it's a way of life that's going to be destroyed by this other person. So there are times in one's life when one must defend what is yours.
And there's, we have to, this is coming from the mouth of someone who was a pacifist, who concluded that I would not fight. If you were to attack my family, I would not have fought back. Now, that, I that was something that I believed when I was quite a bit younger. And I guess, pacifist is somebody who hasn't been mugged yet, but I put a lot of emphasis on the last phrase, there is a time for peace. And I did not want my country, I did not want my family, I did not want myself to be engaged in war. But I think I was mistaken about that. And there is a time for war. And it is at times justified. We, yeah, Carol.
Well, God, he's with the Babylonians, their time wasn't right. But when the time was right for God to punish them, he punished them.
Okay.
Sometimes it may be God that has a hand in this.
Okay. So hang on to that thought, okay? Because now, after this beautiful poem, the Solomon figure, the teacher, Koala, he says this, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God giveth to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has set eternity in their heart, yet so that man cannot find out the work that God hath done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there's nothing better for me or for them than to rejoice and to do good so long as they live. And also, and then I supplied this so it would make better sense to me. Also, I know that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. Let me read that sentence again. I messed it up. And also, I know that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor is the gift of God. I know that whatever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God hath done it that man should fear before him. That which hath been long ago, and that which is to be hath long ago been, and God seeketh again that which passes away. So this represents, I think, as I look at it, a change from what has been said earlier in some ways. Notice the number of times that he says, this is what I know. He said it in verse 12, and then he implied it in verse 13. And he says it in verse 14. So this is in a sense a contrast with what we were talking about in the first two chapters. Because it seemed like then he was saying, I've done all of this, but I don't know anything. What do you see there? What do you see as the impact of those I know statements? Yeah, Ted.
Coming from the wisest man that was ever through the heaven and earth, because God gave him, we can trust that what he says he knows is really what he knows.
Okay. So this is based on, is it based on what he's been able to observe, or is it based on something that God has revealed?
I would say both. I would say it's a combination. God gave him the ability and the wisdom, the ability to use the knowledge to get his pain, but also God gave him wisdom to apply that knowledge in these circumstances. I would say that he may have experienced them, but he had the wisdom to apply that knowledge in a way that would affect them.
Okay. If it is the Solomon figure, if we're talking about Solomon and not someone who speaks like Solomon, it's easy to see that he has known war and he has known peace. Yeah.
Again, we refer back to the first chapter. If we're not talking about Solomon, you're going to have to put long and hard to find the person who was a ruler in Jerusalem of Israel at that time that would fit that history.
Okay. Yeah.
And just because he was a man of peace doesn't mean he didn't know war when his father was there. So his kingdom didn't know it, but he knew war.
He knew war as well. Because remember, when he becomes king, there's the rebellion. And one of his brothers, at least, tries to take over the kingdom. And Solomon has to put that down. So, yes, you're right. Solomon, in most of his reign, enjoyed a time of peace that had not been enjoyed before. Yeah, Ron?
We'll go back to chapter 12. And I think Solomon mentioned it again. Solomon had 1,400 chariots. It was like having a tax. And he had, 14,000 families. So he was prepared for war. But everybody around him was scared to death of him.
Okay.
Because he was so wealthy that he had no. I think if they were afraid, they would be afraid to attack. He was prepared for war, but he enjoyed peace.
Okay. Yeah. Tim?
I really like verses 12 and actually 12 through 14. And I think what he's saying is, and my version, I really like it, at least I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction all in toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. So I think that when you have an eye to this, you can have that happiness and satisfaction in spite of the contrast and comparison in life that we had talked about in the poem. When you find meaning in life that is eternal and that God is in control, you're going to be happy and you're going to be satisfied with your labor, and your toil is not going to be in vain. Your toil is going to be for a purpose, and you're going to find satisfaction in it. And God wants us to be happy. He doesn't want us to go around being sad, gloomy people. He has provided this for our happiness and for our contentment. He's provided that purview and that long view of eternity, that not everything is limited to what's here on earth. To those time constraints that we have, those constraints that God has imposed. And that's fine and good for here, but we have to have that view for eternity. And I think that's what he's saying. When you've got that view for eternity, you're going to be happy people.
Okay. He's made everything beautiful in his time. He's put eternity in their heart. Okay? So that's absolutely true. But we have a very difficult time understanding the concept of eternity because we live in a world of time. And it's hard to understand that God said, you will die. Like the article that's in the bulletin today that I lifted from LaGuardia Smith. I wish I was as good a writer as he is. But God told Daniel, do what you're doing now. You're suffering a great deal. There will be a time for you to rest, and then you'll get your reward. So, I think it's hard for us to put the right kind of valuation on death. We don't quite understand that. God made death beautiful. It's a hard concept, I think. I don't know if anybody else thinks that, but it's a hard concept. Trust me, you know, I've been there close to death, and you fight tooth and nail not to go there. So, other comments?
Question.
Yeah.
I think that this shows that anything God does is permanent, it's forever, that everything he does is effective and complete. And we can take security from that because we know God's in control of everything. Everything, life, you know, there's time for birth and a time for death and all those things because God's in control of time. And we can either use our time wisely and serve God, or we can not. And still, the only satisfaction on earth that you're going to get physically is by what you do, by what how you work, and mm-hmm. take joy in the produce of your labor.
Okay.
So I think it's a way to, you can look at death and say it is beautiful. For Christians, it's a beautiful thing because they get to go home.
Okay.
I think that's huge. Okay. You know, it's a big thing. So God's in control, and we need to fear him. We need to respect him because he's in control, not us. We don't have any control over what happens in our lives. Okay. None, really.
And you... Nobody's going to get to heaven until they die. Well, a few people, because they'll be alive when Jesus comes again. But nobody's going to get to heaven until you die. Yeah, Margaret.
So do you think that time changes your perception of death? I think when you're young, you cling to life. And as you get older, you look forward to eternity.
That's an outstanding point. I have not been at the point where my body is no longer a pleasant place to be. I have never lived through chronic pain. I have never lived through the horrors of cancer. And I think with time, we sometimes understand better what that's about. I had a friend who had tinnitus ringing in his ears. He said, I prayed to God that he would take the tinnitus away because I couldn't sleep. You know, your ears constantly ring, and it's not just a minor problem. It's a major ringing in your ears. He said, I finally got to the point where I was willing to say, if you can't take the tinnitus away, take my hearing away. And you can't get, you're never going to get to that point until you've suffered from tinnitus. You're never going to get to the point of welcoming death until you're convinced that the resurrection is better than what you got here. And we're going to spend some time talking about resurrection. That's not something that I have frequently talked about. And so we're going to spend some time on Sunday night talking about resurrection and what that means and what the resurrection kind of means to us. You know, we lump it into the Lord's Supper, but it's not part of the Lord's Supper when you really get down to it. The Supper is all about Jesus' death, his substitutionary sacrifice for us. The resurrection, he never said, remember that I came back. He said, remember that I died. So, there's a sense in which we're just not going to understand some of this until we've had enough experience with time. So let me get to some takeaways. I think this is a clear break. The tenor of the book and the tenor of his lecture, if this is a big lecture that Koheleth gives, the tenor of his lecture seems to change. here at chapter 3. Futility, interestingly, futility never appears in this section. Now, I think maybe it's implied, I can't remember who made the comment, but we get frustrated when we make plans and they don't go the way that we thought they were going to go. I mean, I get frustrated when I make a plan to be in a particular place at a particular time, and the person I'm meeting is 5 minutes late. That just blows my mind. And James, the fourth chapter, verses 13 through 17, James says, you say tomorrow we're going to go to such and such a city and we'll buy and sell and get gain. What you should say is, if it's God's will. The futility here, if it's in this last portion of the book, the futility is, I don't control it. And I relate it back to the question that Coelus poses. After viewing Proverbs, or after reading Proverbs, we're confronted with Ecclesiastes. Proverbs says, righteous people prosper. You look at the world around you and you think, no, it doesn't work that way sometimes. Sometimes righteous people don't prosper. So how do I explain that? Well, I could explain that if I could control time, and I could control all of the events that are a part of time, but I can't. So maybe that's the concept that he's trying to present here. Don't be frustrated that you can't control time as a way of explaining why wicked people suffer. Accept the fact that God is in control. Okay? Other comments, and then we'll close. Carol.
God is in control, and as I believe it was Colin said, he's content whether he has or he doesn't have. And I think that is not fertility, but it's the fact that you are content because God is in your life, and he shows you how to be happy with little. I mean, people who went through the depression, they were still, lots of them, happy, even though they didn't have anything like what they had before.
That's a good point. Good point. Yeah, Kim. What time are we supposed to end? At 11. Okay. Go ahead.
Our humanness or our humanity makes it very difficult for us to really put our heads around eternity and what that really means, because we are limited by time and space, and God is not. And Sharon and I were talking a few weeks ago in our class, and I posed the question, when did God begin? And that's hard for us as human beings to think that God doesn't have a beginning or an end, that he is. And he always has been. And even saying he has been is my humanness giving it a time frame, giving him a time frame. So I think the writer, the author here, really talks to our humanity, and then really talks to that, talks about deity and how when we transfer or transcend from our humanness and our limitations, so really understanding what it's like to be a spiritual being with an eternal dimension, for lack of a better word, then I think that's when we can be happy and content. So when I apply that to everybody, the people who don't have that understanding, I have to have a great deal of compassion for them, because how frustrating life is. How frustrating it is when you are feeling out of control and you don't have control of the things that
the time, your time, like you were saying, I get really frustrated when I don't have control over this. When things happen to me, I feel like I'm a victim all the time. You know, I'm a victim of war or a victim of somebody being silent or somebody tearing down and somebody not building up and somebody, you're a victim all the time. How unhappy and unsatisfying your life must be. And so when we interact with people in the world who live in that condition, we need to have compassion and understand why they are so frustrated. And then be willing to share eternity with them. And say, I found something in my life that gives me a different perspective. And it's hard to do because it's hard to identify with that source of frustration. But I do think that in our culture, a lot of that source of frustration is feeling like we have something imposed upon us that we can't control and we don't see any way out. And we don't see that we're built for an eternal, we are created for an eternal existence. We're not created to be here. We're created for eternity.
Okay. Other comments? Yeah. Go ahead, Gerald.
They don't have the Lord with good, alcohol, you know, whatever, anything to try and minimize what they're going through, the effects of it.
It's yeah, they're living the wrong life, as you know. Yeah.
It is bad.
Yeah. You have to feel for people who don't have this perspective. Then life becomes a series of frustrations. Carol.
Something that Christians grow into.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, the amount of frustration you have as a young person when somebody doesn't follow the speed limit and this and that, or they fall out or whatever. But as you become experienced in not only the world but in people's driving skills, but also in God's patience. That, you know, I mean, having somebody have their highlights on, so you put your highlights on, so both of yours are blocked. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, we do a lot of things that don't make sense when it's all said and done. But I think it's a feeling of hopelessness that we can't control time. It's in God's hand, not my hands. I could even cope with bad things happening if I could decide when they were supposed to end. Right? I can deal with a little bit of pain. And we do that. We go to a doctor because something is wrong, and the doctor says you're going to have surgery. And we say, okay, I'll have the surgery, and in 6 weeks, I'll be better. We put a time limit on it, right? And we can cope with it, with the evil that happens, because we feel like we get to control the time, and we don't. That's where the idea of hopelessness or futility or meaninglessness or hevel comes into this discussion. Yeah, Ted, you got the last comment.
I was just going to say, we see that in our culture throughout the world today, how people are so attracted to movies and books and ideas that you can control time. Or travel through, or you would think those things that we read in verse 14 that God said, you know, you have no control of this, and never will. From the beginning to the end, you are a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is not the solution. Being able to control time. This is not the way that we say, okay, bad things are happening to good people, but it's just for a short time. So we're still back to the idea of futility and trying to deal with the observations that we make. Okay.